This is Weather Brains, the show all about weather with a bunch of weather geeks. This is meteorologist James Spann, worked for the ABC television affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama. And really, all of our other panelists are either TV weather people or retired weather service people or a combination thereof. Let's bring in J.B. Elliott, the great weather legend of this United States of America. J.B., how you doing?
Gosh, what a title. I wish I could 10% live up to that. I'm doing good. I feel real good.
Good. Well, it's good to have you with us. We've got Brian Peters. And Brian, where are you tonight?
I'm at home paying for my own bandwidth. Just make sure that everybody is aware of that. You know, I just don't deserve this reputation. You know, JB gets this title, greatest weather legend in the United States. My title, bandwidth thief.
I think the best one was when Brian was down there at the beach somewhere. He had been, you know, pulled up in front of a Starbucks or a, you know, Hooters or something down there.
I can't say the name of the coffee company.
Okay. So it wasn't Starbucks or Hooters then?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're with us, Brian. And joining us is also Kevin Selly. Kevin, out in Dallas, what's happening with you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Is this the show where we're going to complain about stuff other than the weather, or is that coming up?
Sure. I mean, one of these shows, we're just going to have a whole rat hole on, you know, we're just going to gripe like a bunch of grumpy old men here for 30 minutes. So we'll do that before show 100, maybe.
All right.
But if you got something to gripe about tonight, if you do, go ahead.
I'll save them for the big gripe show. Although, did you guys see this? This is a gripe. Let me find it. I got a stack of stuff here.
I knew he had something. Just go for it.
You could tell it was something on his mind.
You know, something is up his craw.
It came off of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's some numbskull. I guess he's the TV critic, Rick Rantamaki. But I am just so tired of the television critics. When they can't find anything else to write about, they don't have anything else to do, they're on a last-minute deadline, and they go and they pick on the weather people in the local market, and they say, oh boy, what a great job it would be to be a weatherman. You get, you know, you're wrong 70% of the time, and you still get paid. And each of these articles, one comes up every month from some numbskull critic in some market, and they all say the same thing over and over and over again. And, you know, guys, it's just old. It's not fresh. No one cares. If you're going to pick on us, come up with something new, and I'll get off.
Plus, it's not true.
And it's not true. That's right. But somehow they see us as good targets. But, you know, Rick, come on. Find something new, pal.
Wow. Now, I'll say this. It just seems to me as an observation that the number of full-time local television critics is dying off in a hurry.
Well, good.
Is the newspaper industry is kind of going through a transformation. And let me say this, I love newspapers. I want them to stay in business and to thrive, but we're all suffering through this change in the new digital era. And I think change is good, but I don't see as many out there as I used to. And how about in Dallas-Fort Worth? Who's on your case, Kevin?
Well, you know, if you want to pick on some kind of a job, let's pick on TV critic and say, I mean, that is a cushy job. But, you know, one of the best ones in the business for a long time at the Dallas Morning News was Ed Bark. And they went through a downsizing of the paper. It's been a little over a year ago now, I guess. But Ed went on and transitioned into the digital world. And he not only talks about Dallas-Fort Worth television, but all national stuff. So if you're interested in television critics, and I'm you know, picking on him a little too hard, but Ed is a good one, and he's a good guy. And he has a good website that he keeps very, very fresh. He just keeps pumping information into that thing. And the website address is Uncle Barky. For Ed Bark, UncleBarky.com. And so if you want to read some good TV critic stuff, he hasn't picked on me, so I like him, and I'll plug his website.
You know, I will never forget when I moved to Dallas-Fort Worth in 1984, the morning after I went on the air for the first time, Bark had a column in the Dallas Morning News. I'll never forget the article, and the headline was Chronology of Controversy. And he went down this long parade of bumbling mistakes made by the channel where I worked, which was Channel 4. And, you know, as hard as it was to read that, being some new guy, everything he wrote was true. I mean, and he would pick on weather people, but I thought that he did a very good job and he was fair. And it seems like now that he's away from Below, he seems a little freer to write about what goes on at Channel 8 over there in Dallas.
Hey, Kevin, is that UncleBarky.com, is that B-A-R-K-I-E or B-A-R-K-Y?
E-Y.
E-Y, okay.
And we need to send Bark an invoice for the free pub he's getting on this show here.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll even do one better and put him a link on the website. But he was frustrated for a number of years at the newspaper because the ABC television affiliate and the newspaper are owned by the same company. You mentioned Belo. And some years ago, they came down from on high and said, you will not write about local news. And that really frustrated him because he wanted to write about not only the ABC affiliate, the company-owned station, but all of them. And, that's kind of one of the things of a local television critic is to write things about the local newscasts. And so he was pretty frustrated for a number of years. And actually, you can read about that on his site as well.
Who owns WBAP?
Who is it now, James? It used to be ABC, and now who bought out ABC? Is it not Cumulus?
WBAP Radio, mainly.
Yeah, these things change hands so often, these radio stations. It's hard to keep up.
I'll find out and tell you while we're talking.
That's the big 820. That's a big clear channel blowtorch out there in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Comes booming in here.
James, I read at one point that something like 70% of the radio stations in the United States had changed hands in the last 10 years.
Wow. I believe it. Radio is a whole different critter these days, and again, like the newspapers and like our business, the television business, they're going through this major transformation. Can they survive? Absolutely, but we've all got to be willing to flow with the changes here, or else we'll shrivel up and die. One of the things I wanted to do on the show tonight, I thought we'd have a little bit of fun. We have really not ever done this question before, and I'd like to go around the panel here and get everybody's answer to this. I want you to think back. And when maybe you were just a young child or maybe a teenager, what is the one thing that got you hooked into weather, the science of meteorology? Maybe it was a weather event. Maybe it was a TV weather person or something else. And, typically everybody that's in this business, there was something that really triggered their interest in this. And I thought I'd share mine while you guys think about, where it started for you. I really think what got me on this path, the very first thing, I was 13 years old in 1969. And you guys recall a hurricane that blew up into the Gulf Coast in August of 69? Anybody?
Yes. With a C?
That's it.
Camille.
The big one. And I remember that night, I was at my grandmother's house, which is well up in northeast Alabama, and had a little transistor radio. All the kids today have iPods. Back then, having a transistor radio was a big deal. And I was just tuning through the dial, really not looking for it, but I stumbled across the big 870, WWL in New Orleans. And there was a guy on that radio station by the name of Nash Roberts. You guys ever heard of this guy?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh,
yeah. He was the legend in New Orleans, but I didn't know the guy. And I was just fascinated by, what he was saying. And he seemed to have a very firm, confident grip on where this thing was going. And I realized this sounds bad. And it was just like this real life drama. And I sat there in my bed literally all night long listening to that. And I finally had to give up the next morning about 8 o'clock when the sun was up. And, the nighttime skip effect went away. But I think that was the very first thing for me. And then in terms of experiencing weather, 4 years after that, again, in 69, I was 13. You go to 1973, and I was just ending my junior year in high school, and there was a huge tornado just about 35 miles down the road from where I was living, my hometown. And my hobby then, and still today, is ham radio. And there was an urgent call for ham radio operators because in 1973, no cell phones, that was it. And ham radio operators, even today, play a crucial role in this. But I went down with some other amateur radio operators down that 35-mile stretch, and we were literally one of the first groups on the scene there. And it was an F4 tornado. The town where we were dispatched, 5 people died. This was a Sunday night. One died in a church, and I will never forget. The darkness, the eerie feel to the air, the strange odor. And I can't to this day tell you guys what that smell was. I know that part of it was pine trees that were twisted, but there was this, it was not very pleasing. And I've heard people that are first responders tell me that that's the smell of death. And they really don't have a good explanation for it either. But we stayed there for 3 days. And I remember that night just like it was yesterday. And remember, that was in 1973. And here we are in 2007. So for me, it was listening to Nash Roberts on WWL during Camille and seeing an F4 tornado playing really in the role of a first responder. And for a little guy in school, that hooked me. So having said that, Brian, now you grew up in New England and kind of wound your way down to school in Florida. What was the big one for you?
Well, actually, James, it was a hurricane, just like you, in manner of speaking here. We had moved to Florida when I was just about to turn 11. And a year later, in September 1960, we went through Hurricane Donna. Actually came ashore around Venice and Naples area of the west coast of Florida and passed by Bradenton, which is the town that we were living in, passed by just to the eastern side of the town, so in the eastern part of Manatee County, which is the county that Bradenton is in. So I got to experience 75-mile-an-hour winds, but what really got me was we had a fellow on television named Roy Leap. And Roy was an institution. He's kind of like Nash Roberts, I think, on the west coast of Florida. But he was not one of these weather weirdos, you know. I mean, he was like you, James, suit, professional, trained in meteorology. Just great. And my parents watched that station, and so I was fascinated by the coverage. And I actually went on to Florida State University because I wanted to take meteorology. And, of course, in Florida, you had two choices, Miami, which was a private university, or Florida State, which was the state university, which I could afford just barely. And so I went on to Florida State after that. And I remember in junior high, it was kind of interesting, you know, the junior high counselors all talking, what do you want to be? What's your future goals? Well, I want to be a meteorologist. You want to be a what? How do you spell that? How do you pronounce that? So that was always kind of interesting. But it's interesting that I went through the National Weather Service and spent 36 years in the Weather Service, and now here I am actually doing what I thought I wanted to do back in junior high and high school, is to be a TV weather person.
Do you know if Roy Leap is still alive?
I think he is. I know he's not on television down there, but I think he still is. And he was a really strong role model for me. I actually was the president of the science club at Manatee High School and got him to come down from Tampa to Bradenton and address the club meeting one time. So it was, you know, really great to meet the person that you really idolized and was a big role model in your life.
You know, I'd love to hear from maybe some of these great legends like a Roy Leap or a Nash Roberts. I think Nash Roberts is still living. Y'all correct me if I'm wrong. Now, in Dallas, Fort Worth, the legend was Harold Taft. And Harold died several years ago, so he is not with us anymore. But I think it would be too cool if just maybe one of these shows, we could get one of these guys to come on and just talk about their career and life and weather and what do they think about all this kind of stuff. But yeah, Leap is a just a tremendous legend down in Tampa. So,
well, you know,
thanks for
go ahead. He was a legend in the professional sense. When I remember, you know, there were weather girls, and I'm not being sexist here. I mean, they had pretty women doing the weather, not because they knew anything about the weather, but because, you know, they were good looking. And we had a guy down in Fort Myers who used to toss up his chalk and catch it with his pocket on his sports jacket.
You know? Nice.
It's like, thank goodness the weather became more like what Roy was and became much more professional. So,
you know, I watch some of these national cable channels, and I still see that deal where there are women. And again, I'm like you, Brian. Some of the best meteorologists in our science are women, but these are very attractive women that obviously have no clue. And why in the world, this day and age, are they on there trying to report the weather? I mean, they should be doing the, you know, Britney Spears or I can't think of it. I'm not a pop. Who are some of these that are wall to wall on TV?
I don't know, but be careful. You're gonna be insulting half the population of the country.
That's probably true. I better stop before I get in trouble. All right, JB. Now you grew up in back in a different part of the decade, and what got you into weather?
Different part of the century, you mean?
I'm about to say I meant century here, a decade. JB's only 8 years old.
Yeah. My story is not near as dramatic as you guys, but in 1946, a small tornado destroyed my uncle and aunt's home in west central Alabama. We lived 6 miles away. Our home was partially unroofed, but no tornado. And the next day, my mom bought me a 29-cent thermometer and a 5-cent composition book at S&H Cress in Tuscaloosa, and I started keeping temperature records, and it grew from that. But I had a natural inborn interest in weather even before that, and when I was in grammar school at Martin Stewart Elementary School, I had a science teacher named W.W. Duncan who was also interested in weather, and he triggered my interest even more. Speaking of Camille, the night you were listening to WWL in Northeast Alabama, I was 2,000 miles away on vacation from the National Weather Service. We were visiting my wise folks near Salt Lake City, and I drove up on the bench area of the Wasatch Mountains, which is a slightly elevated area, not real high up in the mountains, and sat in my car and listened to Nash Roberts at least 4 to 5 hours, and WWL was booming in there, and it was the most dramatic radio stuff I guess I've ever heard.
That's just wild. You know, here I was sitting in my little bed, staying up all night listening to that, and you were way out west listening to it. What a blowtorch.
And we didn't know each other from Adam's Yard Dog, did we?
Nope. And I just wonder if Nash Roberts knew that he had that kind of reach back then. Probably did, don't you think?
I would think so.
Yep. But that was something. All right, Kevin, talk to us now. You're in weather. What got you hooked into this?
You know, I came to it a lot later than you guys. I was probably in my mid to late 20s, and it was because of meeting James Spann. But prior to that, you know, I'd always just been interested in the sky, but for some reason, I guess it just never clicked, or I was never encouraged that way to think that I could actually, you know, learn more about it growing up and do meteorology as a career. It just never occurred to me until much, much later. And I met James in Birmingham when I was actually on the radio. It was a July 4th in the early 80s. James and I met at a function, and he was really nice to me and encouraging and invited me up to watch the newscast. I think I've told this story before, but invited me up to watch the newscast that night, which was very generous. And I will never forget cowering in the back of that studio in the dark while they did that newscast, just in fear for not knowing what was going on and thinking, wow, could I possibly even begin to think I could do this one day?
But he was thinking, I could do better than that goober. I know what he was thinking.
That guy with no hair.
Yeah.
No, but I, you know, James was just very, very encouraging to me. And this is maybe a lesson for anybody who thinks they are interested in the weather and they just listen to this but never thought of as a career is, you know, go find somebody for an internship. Because James, while I was still on the radio, I started out, you know, just coming and hanging out. And then I started drawing maps for you guys. And eventually I started running the radar during severe weather events. And eventually it just kind of worked its way into a job. But it took a while. But an internship and just cozying up to people at the weather service or the local television station, if you can, and just showing some interest. Most of those people are just thrilled to talk about what they do and to share it. And if it turns out something that you don't like, you know, you just move on. But if it is something that you like, it's a real good way to get in there and get your feet wet and learn. And so James got me involved, and one day I'll get you for it, James.
Yep.
And now you're nationwide all over Texas.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah, the intern thing is really good. I look back at all of the interns that we have had with me over the years at the various stations, and most all of them, the ones that chose to stay in it, are doing very, very well. It's pretty amazing. I guess the intern that's in the largest market is in Chicago. In fact, we ought to get her on this show. You know, we had Josh Johnson on here last week. Josh is a former intern, and Josh is over in Atlanta, which is a nice top 10 market. But Ginger Z, and we gave her that. Now, that's not a real name. I can't say a real name because I'll blow her cover. But Ginger Z is in Chicago, so maybe she'll come on here and talk with us one week. She's at the NBC channel, Channel 5, WMAQ. But you're right, Kevin. You know, for the young people that are listening to us, just getting your foot in the door and building some relationships and watching the TV people work and kind of getting plugged in, that's very important for all young people to do.
Yep.
And let me say this, you know, to me, I look back on the people that encouraged me, and my great mentor is also in this group, is JB, who would let me come down to the weather service in the old days and watch him work. And it was something about those old days. It was just incredibly fascinating. He had the old teletype machines and those old Difax charts. You guys remember those, don't you?
Oh, yes.
You know, they came out of that thing wet and had to let them dry, and then you hung them up on the wall. And
the rats machine.
Yeah, that was the rate. Tell them about explain rats for people that are too young, that don't know how you used to do radar.
Back in those days, in the early days, when the first national weather radar network was being set up, they set it up on a grid basis, equally spaced across the country as much as possible. But often the forecast office was well removed from the radar site. So we had a transmission of the radar, our home radar, sent into our weather office by a facsimile machine, and we would get a printout every 5 minutes, but it was on cheap fax paper, black and white fax paper. And the radar operators would write notes on the overlay on the radar, and the picture of that would come in, and they would, for example, they would say MT 460, which meant 46,000 at a certain location, or hook radar echo, or hook possibly indicated. And we did have an open telephone line to them, though, of course, and during warning situations, we would talk almost constantly by open telephone line. But the picture, I'd give anything if I had saved a roll of that rat's paper.
It looked like somebody threw up on the paper. I mean, it was just useless to me. In fact, I drove this past Saturday evening, I drove past an old abandoned National Weather Service WSR 57 site where they originated those racks, those old rats papers. It was kind of sad, Jay. You know the one I'm talking about, JB. It was the one down in Brent, Alabama.
Yes.
In fact, that radar facility was destroyed by the tornado that got me into this. The night I went down with those folks from Tuscaloosa, that was the same tornado. And I drove right past that thing. And the radome is still there. The tower's there. The radome is there. And took a bunch of photographs. So it just brought back some very good memories. And by the way, we'd love to hear your memories. If there's something that really has gotten you turned on to weather, whether you're doing this professionally or just as an amateur, let us know. Our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Even though you're sharing a story and not a question, we need a feedback address. We'll see if we can get one of those. But right now, the email address we're using is question@weatherbrains.com. We'd love to hear your story.
One day later, I will tell you the miraculous sequence of events that let me get into the National Weather Service. It was unbelievable. But it's too long a story for tonight.
We'll do it next week.
JB, though, about, you know, we're talking about this radar, and when you get it on these rats paper, over the last, it's been 2, 3 to 10 years, the big thing in a given market has been, we have our own radar, all the television stations, we have our own radar, and we're faster than the National Weather Service. And the National Weather Service picked up speed when they went from the 57s to the 88Ds. But there's a period of time where that data has to be processed and so on and so forth. So my question is, given today that there's such a big emphasis on how quickly you're getting your radar images, back in the day when you were having to use that paper, were you just happy because you had that, or were you guys chomping at the bit saying, well, this thing has got to be minutes and minutes and minutes old. What can we do to fix this? Does that make sense as a question?
We were elated, Kevin, that we had that much radar information. Absolutely elated.
Brian, did you ever work with rats?
Oh, yes. And, you know, I hate to say this, it wasn't that long ago when you get right down to it. You know, the Doppler radar network began to be deployed in the very late 80s. I mean, it's called the WSR 88D. That's the year in which the contract for the radar equipment was awarded. And so the radar actually was deployed in the early 90s. And while we used something better than that, when I came to Birmingham in 1989, we were still using the RATS for warning purposes and talking to the radar operators via a hotline. So it's not that long ago, really, James.
Wow.
I well remember one rat's picture that came in on the night of the super outbreak in 1973, and the radar operators at Centerville had written a note on there, max top 660, 66,000 feet, cell moving northeast at 65 knots. That was the tornado moving in on Guin, Alabama.
Wow. Massive F5. That's great.
Wish I had saved that.
Yep. Great stuff, guys. Let's take a break here. Let's check out WeatherBrains 101 for this week.
WeatherBrains 101 with Professor Peters.
Last week, I spoke of the thermodynamic diagram called the SKU-T log P, which is commonly used in the U.S. Two of the main lines on a SKU-T are wet and dry adiabats, lines that approximate the change in air as it follows adiabatic heating and cooling processes that commonly occur due to a change in the pressure of a gas. Adiabatic cooling occurs when the pressure of a substance is decreased, such as when it expands into a larger volume. An example of this is when the air is released from a pneumatic tire. The outlet air will be noticeably cooler than the tire. Adiabatic cooling does not have to involve a fluid. Adiabatic cooling also occurs in the Earth's atmosphere with orographic lifting and lee waves, and this process can form pileus or lenticular clouds if the air is cooled below the dew point. On the other hand, adiabatic heating occurs when the pressure of a gas is increased. An example of this is what goes on when using a bicycle pump. After using a pump to inflate a pneumatic tire or ball, the barrel of the pump is found to have heated up as a result of adiabatic heating. Diesel engines rely on adiabatic heating during their compression stroke to elevate the temperature sufficiently to ignite the fuel. Adiabatic heating also occurs in the Earth's atmosphere when an air mass descends, for example, in a katabatic wind or a fern wind flowing downhill. Such temperature changes can be quantified using the ideal gas law or the hydrostatic equation for atmospheric processes. It should be noted that no process is truly adiabatic. Many processes are close to adiabatic and can be easily approximated by using an adiabatic assumption, but there is always some heat loss. There is also no such thing as a perfect insulator. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Very nice. Thank you, Brian. That was a good bit on adiabats there. And by the way, speaking of Brian, I think we've got some email comments here. Let's kind of go through some of these you sent on to us.
You mentioned that, of course, we get feedback, and we don't answer all of them, but I noticed that we did get a number of different emails this week, and I thought, I don't know the answer to one of these, but I thought we'd post it for the crowd. Mike Wilhelm of Vinemont, Alabama, wrote, "Do any of you know why the National Hurricane Center uses the term INVEST as part of the name for tropical disturbances before they become tropical storms?" And I think I know the answer, but does anybody really know the answer?
I could guess at it, but it would be a guess.
Well, mine's a guess, but JB, do you know?
No, I don't. I just assumed that was meaning it still had to be investigated and they were going to send the recon fly, but that wouldn't make sense to put that on there.
Well, I think that's what it is, JB, is, you know, we come from a time where communication was a lot more difficult than it is today in terms of transmission, and so everything was shortened. And I do believe that INVEST was a short way to say, you know, need to investigate, but that's a little bit longer. So I think that's where that came about. So,
maybe.
Mike, I hope that answers your question. And then we got accused, I don't know the name, but NLR in Salt Lake City, Utah, accused us of forcing him to buy a weather station.
Great.
And so I don't know if he's sending us a bill or not, but he says, now having been here for about 7 years, I want you guys to remember that the lake effect snows do occur outside of the Great Lakes. They fall there almost every year. And so he said to keep up the good work, but I think he blames us for buying the weather station. And then let's see. Here it is. Jim Woodruff, I think, in Memphis. I really like Jim. Jim's really on my list of good people because he submitted a question to WeatherBrains gang suggesting a gift for me for Christmas. But I was a little insulted by the gift because it's a Wi-Fi Finder shirt.
Nice.
So this this reputation here, it's actually what it is. Believe it or not, it's a T-shirt, black cotton T-shirt, with an animated decal and a small battery pack that finds Wi-Fi signals for you. So
what,
Jim,
what does this thing do? Does the shirt light up when you got a good Wi-Fi signal or what? I mean,
it does. It glows. It's an animated glowing shirt. And it's only $30. So I would love to have one of those for Christmas.
You know what we need to do is get a matching helmet. Little light comes on the top of the helmet that starts spinning around when he's got a good Wi-Fi signal. So.
Hey, that would be great.
That'd be awesome.
Chuck in Roebuck, which is just outside of Birmingham, Alabama, the kind of the northeast part of the Birmingham area, said, any idea when this drought will be over? Is it possible to forecast the end of a drought? And my answer to Chuck is, I don't think so, Chuck. I don't think we can really forecast the end of it. Because I've decided right now for central Alabama, I'm not forecasting rain again until I look out my window and I see water droplets falling from the sky.
Yeah, it's dangerous to try to forecast the end of a drought. And there's some indications that it may last into the next year, isn't it, guys?
Yeah, there's been a lot of hype on the national media about the water supply for Atlanta drying up next year.
I saw that.
That was the lead story on the news that's on my channel. I'm an ABC channel here, and they did show some shots of Lake Lanier, which, as you guys know, it's northeast of Atlanta, and that thing looked like it needs some more water in the pond up there.
Right.
The lakes around central Alabama look like they're in bad shape.
Yeah, and drizzle will not do it.
And understand that this doesn't affect our buddy out there in Dallas. You know, he's washing away with too much water. How far ahead of normal are you out there, Kevin?
Boy, you would have asked me that. I'd have to go and check the it's in some spots, I believe it's more than 15 inches in portions maybe south central or southwest Texas. I'll go up and look. You know what? While we were talking, I found Invest. Can I do that? I found
sure.
That
oh, he Googled it. Great.
I Googled it and didn't come up with a result, Kevin.
No, it's on the glossary of NHC terms. It is a weather system for which a tropical cyclone forecast center is interested in collecting specialized data sets or running model guidance. Once a system has been designated as an INVEST, data collection and processing is initiated on a number of government and academic websites, including Naval Research, University of Wisconsin. The designation of a system as an INVEST does not correspond to any particular likelihood of development of the system into a tropical cyclone, yada, yada, yada. So there you go.
See, you learn a lot on this show.
Yes.
Really do.
All right, let's roll with Mr. Bill Murray and see what he's got for us this week.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of October 9th through the 15th. And it was back on October 9th, 1954, that famed Weather Bureau hurricane forecaster and Alabama native Grady Norton died of a stroke while at his home in Miami. He had just worked a 12-hour shift plotting the course of Hurricane Hazel. And even though he had been warned about his medical condition, he continued to forecast in order to provide warnings about the dangerous hurricane that would go on to blast the North Carolina coast. On October 15th, Norton was just 60 years old. He is widely recognized as the original director of the National Hurricane Center, even though that position wouldn't be created for many, many years. Norton established an extraordinary reputation as an expert forecaster who could innately tell what storms were going to do and then communicate that to coastal residents. And it was back in 2005 on October 10th that Atlantic Tropical Storm Vince made landfall in a most unusual location, southwestern Spain. It was the first tropical cyclone in recorded history to actually make landfall there. Top winds were 45 miles an hour. Now, back in 1886, the town of Indianola, Texas, was a bustling town, a bustling seaport on the Texas Lower Coast. It had experienced a hard hit from a hurricane in 1869 and back in 1875. The 1875 hurricane had destroyed three-fourths of the town and killed 106 people. But the residents resolutely rebuilt the town. But it was on October 10, 1886, that an even more devastating blow came. A deadly hurricane swept through the rebuilt town of Matagorda Bay, sweeping it completely away. Over 250 people died. The storm-weary residents picked up their belongings and moved away. The town was never rebuilt. And it was on October 12, 1979, that Typhoon Tip in the northwestern Pacific Ocean achieved the dubious distinction of being the strongest tropical cyclone ever measured on Earth, at least by central pressure. with a central pressure of 870 millibars and estimated surface winds of 190 miles an hour were recorded as it swept through the Luzon Strait. And on October 15th, give a nice remembrance to Evangelista Torricelli, the Italian physicist and mathematician who invented the barometer. He was born on this date, October 15th, in 1608. That's This Week in Weather History. Back to the guys at WeatherBrains.
Thanks a lot to Bill Murray for that episode of This Week in Weather History. You know, Murray has not been on here live with us lately. What's he up to? He travels a lot. Anybody know where he is this week?
Heidi.
I think he just got back from Salt Lake a couple of days ago, but I don't know where he is now.
I'm not sure either. And I just like Kevin, I have been checking on Roy Leap, and everything I can find so far indicates that he is still alive. There is nothing about him being dead. So we'll maybe have to follow up and see if we can find him.
Yep, and if anybody knows of Nash Roberts' health and welfare, let us know too. Again, our email address here for any comments or questions is question, that's singular, question at weatherbrains.com. And we'd love to hear from you. And, you know, we're coming up on episode 100. We'll try and get some cool stuff to give away for that. But we thank you for listening, and thanks for staying subscribed. Have a wonderful week, and God bless.
DFW in Houston, about 16 inches above average for this year. WBAP is owned by Citadel Broadcasting.
Ah.
And Uncle Barky is B-A-R-K-Y, UncleBarky.com. And I'm done.
Kevin is a fountain of information.
He is an encyclopedia.